Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, Wisconsin has one operating nuclear power plant in Two Rivers. It's called the Point Beach Nuclear Plant, bordered by farms and Lake Michigan. And we're going to maybe talk a little bit about that plant, but also learn all about nuclear technology today and what things in our life can benefit from nuclear innovations. Couple of engineers for you today from the University of Wisconsin. Michael Corradini, former director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, professor emeritus of nuclear engineering. He founded the Wisconsin Energy Institute back in 2006. Mike Corradini, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
And also, Raluca Scarlett is an associate professor of engineering physics in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Raluca, good to have you here, too. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, as you listen in to these two experts, what's on your mind about nuclear energy? What do you want to know about nuclear research maybe going on at UW? Curious about nuclear reactors? Let's join in. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, when we talk about nuclear energy, I think the mind goes quickly to nuclear reactors. Is there more to nuclear energy than reactors? Raluca, you want to comment on that?
Well, that answering that question is similar to answering the question about, is there more to chemistry?
Yeah.
That we know that matter, that atoms are made out of nuclei and electrons, and chemistry has to do with what electrons do, and nuclear technology has to do with what the protons and the neutrons do. And so why ignore half of what matter is made of? So yes, we nuclear technology has to do with has implications in agriculture and industrial processes and food and nutrition and water and health and medicine and energy. For example, the pest management for the Zika virus uses nuclear technology. Breastfeeding education across the world uses nuclear technology for implementation. So it's really quite a broader range of applications that touch all of our lives.
The president recently signed the Nuclear Energy Innovations Capabilities Act. I think I've got that title correct. It's expected to speed up development of advanced reactors. Mike Corradini, maybe you can talk about it. What are advanced reactors and how do they differ from traditional ones? And
well, I'll ask Raluca to help since she's an expert in that area. But currently we have about 99 reactors in the United States, all light water reactors. They call it light water because it's cooled by ordinary water. The advanced reactors are a little bit different in the sense that they have a wide range of technologies, all, as Raluca noted, nuclear fission is the basis, but they're cooled by other sources, for example, sodium. Similar to some of the test reactors that are in China now or in India or in Russia, gas-cooled reactors, high-pressure gas, helium coolant, and then also what I'll call a molten salt solution, essentially a fluoride-lithium composition of a high-temperature fluid, which has very good thermal properties and, again, was cooling the reactors. So in all three cases, different coolants with different geometrical arrangements.
Yeah, and they're better, Raluca?
I would say that the term advanced reactors is a reflection of the failure of the nuclear industry to iterate on to evolve technology. Mm-hmm. We don't really hear people talk about the advanced phone, the current phone, and the advanced phone. There are many different types of technologies out there for cell phones. So I think advanced nuclear technology means a much more diverse solution to nuclear energy. And are they better? Well, we want to have more options than what we started off with in the 1950s.
So, there's so many callers online. Every one of our lines is filled. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in a bit. Rich in Two Rivers was first up, so we'll let Rich go first. Hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you for having me on the air, Larry. My question to your guest is, I live in Two Rivers, And there's actually two nuclear plants, and they closed the one down. And then the other one, they dropped it down to whatever low capacity. I have friends that work there. And I did get a letter in the mail a couple of years ago that said that the reason why they were closing the one down was because it was 0.01% more to produce the energy than they could do from natural gas or coal or whatever. And I just want to hear your expert's comment on that.
Yeah, Rich, thanks for calling.
So I'll try that, Rich. I think whatever letter you got from, I assume, Wisconsin Public Service, which is up in that region, is pretty much accurate in that the cost of natural gas coming into the state, whether it comes in from Canada or from the south, is low enough that the production cost using natural gas is a tad bit cheaper than it was in nuclear power for the Kewaunee plant. I think that's the plant you're speaking of. And Dominion, which owned the plant, could not basically continue operation because the cost it could charge versus the cost to run the plant was a bit lower than it needed to make a profit.
Yeah,
that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks for calling, Rich. Appreciate your call. Roger in South Milwaukee will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Roger.
Good morning, Larry. First of all, a little bit of background. 40 years in power generation, both coal and nuclear. But my question is on the ability of advanced reactors to load follow with so much wind and solar energy now in the market and gas-fired plants hitting the bottom price tiers. Nuclear plants have typically been base-loaded, and then all of the other energy builds on top of that. So for nuclear units to be viable, I believe they need the ability to follow load during the day, where right now they are base load. So my question is, what is the ability of the advanced reactors to follow load during the day?
All right. And Raluca, maybe you could take that and talk he talked about load following and so forth. Explain what's going on there and then hopefully be able to answer Roger's question.
I think the main motivation for innovating advanced reactors is to match the needs of the current market and to be economically competitive. And so one of the needs will be load following, and advanced nuclear technology can certainly meet that need.
And what is load following?
Load following is when the demand for electricity consumption changes. Maybe somebody turns on turns off a switch, and then the production of nuclear energy responds to that change in demand.
Okay.
And so advanced reactors can certainly be designed with that in mind. And current reactors do not typically load follow, but they could also.
Yeah, I was just going to add that in the United States, Raluca is correct. In France, because there's such a large fraction of their energy, 75% is nuclear, they currently load follow. But they have to do it with certain restrictions based on the rate at which they increase or decrease power.
Yeah, interesting.
And I'll add that, for example, reactors that are cooled by salt, molten salt reactors, can essentially be controlled on load following. So the reactor responds by itself to the load demand.
There you go. Roger, does that help out?
Yes, it does.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
And, of course, nuclear reactors on submarines are famous for load following.
Yeah. All right, there we go. Thank you again. Mark in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, guys. I just want to say thank you for bringing up this topic and its importance to the country. I was a former nuclear machinist mate for the Navy. And my question is regards to how are we using the university to try and further public understanding of nuclear power and combat the negative press that's been associated with nuclear power?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well,
I'll start.
Go ahead, Mike.
Raluca is a current professor in the department, so she can speak to what's going on. But historically, I think the way you made a couple of points that I guess I'd modify. You said the negative press. I would just say that the press has a whole range of opinions. and which come from various individuals and groups. I think the main task of the university is education, and therefore what we want to do is present the facts as best we can and let people sort out their opinions from that. And that's historically what we've done. At Madison, we have an extremely active local section of the American Nuclear Society by the students. And so a large fraction of our education is within the middle schools, high schools, grade schools, where the students go out and talk about the technology and explain what's going on. So that's kind of a historical background.
Yeah, Raluca, to add to that.
I'll say that there's a lot of work to be done in the area of communication, and there's a lot to be learned both ways, because we want to design reactors that are appropriate for specific communities and that fit the market. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done, and there's a lot of active research at the university on risk communication and communication and community engagement.
Yeah, and some of it coming out of my home department at the UW in life sciences communication, Dietram Scheufele and so forth. But the question comes to my mind then is to what research are you doing? I mean, obviously the education you do comes out of the research that you're doing and the work that you're doing. Could you talk a bit more about that, Raluca?
So the research that I do is on safety analysis and development of molten salt reactors, and I also have an interest in ethics, in engineering ethics, and how do we responsibly develop technology and evaluate its impact on society? How do we responsibly involve all members of societies that are impacted by this kind of technology and ensure that there's justice in the deployment of a technology. And I am not a believer in engineers as decision makers. I think that engineers work in the service of society, and so we should be very good at listening to what society needs from us. And so there's active research in that area.
Mark, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. We are visiting today about nuclear energy with our two guests, Michael Corradini, former director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, professor emeritus of nuclear engineering, and Raluca Scarlett is an assistant professor of engineering physics in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Questions for them, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Kate Archer Kent, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, I think. Oh, yeah, there she is in the studio. Jill Nadeau is our producer, and taking your calls here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at nuclear engineering today with our two guests from the University of Wisconsin, Michael Corradini, professor emeritus. Raluca Scarlett is an assistant professor of engineering physics in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. John in Bayfield County, we'll turn to you next. John, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just going to make some observations. I'm really glad to hear you are airing a program with some nuclear engineers. Just as a bit of background, I'm an electrical engineer in low noise equipment, so nothing to do with nuclear. I have a solar powered house that I built. I have invested in wind power, so I'm not anti-renewables at all. But I think that the need for nuclear power, if we're going to make any progress against global warming, is huge and grossly understated and understood in society. And I have all the praise. The University of Wisconsin Nuclear Energy Program is great, but unfortunately, a lot of the University of Wisconsin system has been loaded up with people that really, you just don't hear programs like this. And I think it's something that is a big failing of the university to support outreach and get real information about nuclear power out. Oh. So long overdue, and I'm really happy to hear it. And I think the idea of, you know, molten salt reactors and using waste fuel to generate huge amounts of more electricity rather than trying to get rid of it. There's so many advantages here. I'm all ears, so I'll be happy to listen to it.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, John. Appreciate it. Comments? Do you want to go ahead, Raluca?
So I absolutely agree that we need to realize how pressing the climate change challenge, the global warming challenge is, and we need to realize that we need all of the options we can use, including nuclear. And I think to make that happen, nuclear technology needs to meet the needs of the current market and to be economically competitive. And at the University of Wisconsin, we have quite a bit of interface with startup companies that work on commercializing new nuclear technology that can be economically competitive, and most importantly, that can be deployed as quickly as possible. Because if it's going to take 30 years to build a new nuclear reactor, that's going to be really too late. We need to deploy new technology that's commercially competitive as soon as possible, and that is pressing.
Yeah, and so you're working with many companies.
We work with several companies that my area of research is in molten salt and salt cooled reactors, and we interface with startup companies that look to commercialize this technology. And on our end, we push the science to help accelerate their commercialization. And then on their end, they teach us about what are their most challenging technical hurdles and how can we help them accelerate.
Wow, interesting. Do you think we're falling behind, staying abreast, moving forward?
You mean as a nation?
Yeah.
Well, I think that, from the standpoint of magnitude, we're still the largest users of nuclear energy for electricity production. I think Raluca started the whole thing off very well by pointing out we have things in medicine and in mm-hmm. security that nuclear is the technology is used for. But you do see around the world that the two countries which are actively engaging, actually a number of countries, but the ones that you see are China and Russia, are offering the technology broadly around the world. The Koreans, the South Koreans, have been quite successful recently in what they've offered to countries in the Middle East where they're building plants for the UAE. But I think we have to maintain our activity in the area, so we're going to lose our influence. And part of that influence goes beyond just electricity. It goes into security. It goes into maintaining a peaceful world.
Yeah.
And that I think, translates into continuing to invest in the technology.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks for that comment. Mike in Wausau, it's your turn. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Really enjoying the program. John, the prior caller, really addressed sort of what I was going to get at as well. My question was more specifically about how nuclear is viewed by environmentalists, people who consider themselves environmentalists. Because on one hand, it's obviously a great source of power in the global warming debate, but it's still seen as this boogeyman, I think, by most people who would consider themselves environmentalists. And how do you address that going forward and get those attitudes to change? And then a quick follow-up question I had to your response to John was, have there been any studies that factor in the carbon cost of cheap natural gas that show that nuclear would actually be more affordable if you factor in that carbon cost? So those are my questions.
All right. Raluca?
I'll start with the first one. I think Raluca can handle the second one. So this is Mike Wade made the comment. Mm-hmm. So Mike, the one piece of information that was news to me as of about 2 days ago is that the Union of Concerned Scientists, which has historically been quite against nuclear energy, has just come out with a new study and released their findings that without nuclear power, the ability to have deep decarbonization in the world is essentially not going to be met, which is a tremendous change in opinion. Historically, ever since I was in school, which was a while ago, I won't say how long, the Union of Concerned Scientists was quite against nuclear power as a source of electricity or as a source of energy. And they've changed that primarily because they see the inability to continue to fight global emissions and CO2 emissions in particular. So that's one big change from a quite well-known and influential environmental group.
Yeah, Raluca?
And I'll go back to the conversation we had earlier about communication. I think think it's unfortunate that the conversation about nuclear tends to be so polarizing, nuclear or no nuclear. Mm-hmm. I think the conversation should be more around what kind of nuclear and what are the expectations of nuclear energy, because there's a enormous range of technology options in terms of nuclear technology. There's not one kind of reactor or one kind of plant. There's a range, and so I think that the outcome of a future of nuclear industry being impacted by this conversation, it would be most beneficial if the environmental movement engaged with nuclear technologists to say, this is what we would like to see of nuclear. And if nuclear is successful at these following points, then we think this is a splendid technology, rather than being sort of black and white, we don't like the word nuclear, and therefore we'll push it out on principle.
Yeah. You were talking about the different types of reactors. What about there? I've heard about small or even micro reactors. What are they, and could they become a reality?
Well, so those are kind of definitions of all the technologies that Ray Luca went through. And when they use the terminology small, they're assuming, I think they mean a small power output, something similar to maybe, I'll use Kewaunee as an example. Kewaunee was approximately 600 megawatts electric. A small modular reactor is considered something that's about half or a tenth of that size.
Okay.
Okay, so a smaller module or a smaller component, which have many modules together on a site. The new terminology that now is being used, micro reactor, is interesting because, in fact, just the 2019 Defense Appropriation Bill was just passed, and they put in there a section in it which is asking the Defense Department to consider for remote sites off the grid or away from major cities to essentially have a stable, secure power source of a small reactor. And now what we're talking small is about 100 times smaller than Kewaunee. So instead of 600 megawatts electric, like 6 megawatts, which would run a small community, for example, out in the mining areas of northern Canada. So that's what it is the size of it, but for different applications in different areas.
Yeah, very interesting. Mike, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Joey in Warrens, Wisconsin. Let's go to you next. Joey, thank you for calling.
Oh, howdy. I just had a quick question. It's a really interesting topic, but I was wondering about waste. I know you guys were talking about advanced reactors, and I don't really know that much about nuclear. You guys talking about education, too. I was wondering, is there going to be, like, less waste? Because from what I understand, they kind of put the waste in barrels and hide it underground. So I was just wondering if you could talk about that.
I'll start. I'll pass it on to Reluca. So currently, light water reactors have all reactors. I won't just say light water reactors. But all reactors have a couple of types of waste streams. One is the fuel after it is used and has been used to the point that you cannot make electricity from its fission process is sometimes called spent fuel. And that is a high-level waste, so it's quite radioactive. It has to be essentially taken out of the environment. What is being done internationally is Sweden and Finland have essentially sited repositories in their countries for the disposal of that waste by essentially burying the spent fuel. Another approach is the French, where they reprocess the waste and then recycle the usable fuel back into their reactors and then essentially concentrate the unusable material for eventual disposal, but they have still yet to site a repository. The third approach for that sort of waste is to essentially store it above ground until we have come up with socially acceptable place to bury it. And that's what's being done in the United States. There are two proposals, one from New Mexico and one from Texas, to essentially accumulate the spent fuel, ship it to those areas in eastern New Mexico or western Texas, and store it above ground while a repository is sited in the United States. And that could be stored for decades. It is being stored for decades now on sites, but now they want to centralize it. So that's high-level waste. Low-level waste has always been disposed of. And when I say low-level waste, it's things that you see used as material in hospitals for medical processes and such.
So I would say that the story of waste management in the nuclear energy industry has been a tremendous success compared to waste management in fossil fuel energy. because we have to deal with maybe 4 pounds of used material per person per lifetime in the nuclear industry, compared to 6 million pounds of carbon dioxide that we just dump in our planet's atmosphere from fossil fuel. 6 million pounds of gaseous waste, to me, seems much less responsible than 4 pounds of solid waste that we very carefully handle and debate over how we should best handle it, but we certainly very carefully handle it.
Yeah, very interesting.
But in terms of advanced reactors and how they may handle waste, I think that the very pressing challenge now is global warming. And we have to focus on a commercially competitive source of energy, not on saving the problem of the 4 pounds that might be 3 pounds or 2 pounds.
Really interesting. I had never heard those figures before about the waste, and that really kind of drives it home for sure. Joey, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in too. We just lost a caller who may have had the same question to ask, but if you have a question, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Larry and Racine emailed to say the Zion, Illinois plant closed 20 years ago. It's still there. Are the costs to close a plant considered when pricing nuclear power? How long-term storage problem of nuclear, you know, again, asking about the waste problem.
And this was Larry?
Yeah, Larry and Racine.
Not you.
No, Larry and Racine.
Well, a little background. The first nuclear power plant I worked on was in Zion in 1971, so I'm very familiar with that. It is closed. It has been decommissioned, all paid for already by fees accumulated during its operation. And I think it closed in 1993, about 25 years ago. So that plant actually is being dismantled as we speak. And all the, all the pieces of the plant are being essentially transported off-site. So that one is essentially done. What they're using it for, though, is they're using the turbine generator. I'm sorry to be so technical, but they're using the turbine generator to stabilize the grid in that area. It turns out you need to always have some sort of rotating equipment so that you can stabilize the electrical grid in various parts of the country. And so they've been using the turbine generator set from Zion for the last 25 years to stabilize the electricity flow in that region of the Wisconsin-Illinois border.
Interesting.
Now, it's not needed anymore, but that was their what they were using it for in the last 25 years.
Oh, interesting. And let's see, let's take another call. Margie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Margie.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having this show. I'm delighted to hear public discussion about nuclear power and delighted to hear the news about UCS. I'm part of a new group called Rethinking Nuclear, and one of the things that we've wondered about is whether it would be helpful to have in Wisconsin a clean energy standard as opposed to a renewable portfolio standard. And I'll let your guests explain what those two are. I assume that they are familiar with both of those terms.
Margie, thank you. Mike?
Margie, let me give you again a comparison, because I think your question is quite important. We just finished a study. I was co-director of a study that was just released from MIT about the future of nuclear energy. And one of the things we had in the policy part of the discussion was pointing to New York and Illinois, where they have now engaged in what is called the zero energy or zero emissions credit for all low carbon technologies. So, for example, in Illinois, they basically look at the cost of producing electricity, say, from a gas plant and from a nuclear plant. And as we talked about in Kewaunee earlier, it's a little bit more costly to do that. That delta difference there is about what the plant has to run at. But there is a standard put out by the EPA called the social cost of carbon. And what they've done in Illinois is they basically said that they would take that differential social cost of carbon And look at that differential and give that as a zero emissions credit to the nuclear plants. In particular, they've looked at Clinton and Quad Cities. Same sort of thing has happened now in New York, and it's called a zero emission credit. And I think that comes closest to what you were talking about by a clean energy standard. It's more of a payback for the low carbon technologies, and it's now been given to both nuclear and renewables in Illinois and in New York State. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about.
Ray Luca, you were going to add to that as well? No? Margie, is that what you were getting at?
It was. I'm familiar with the New York and Illinois and Connecticut and New Jersey plans. I'm just wondering whether your guests think that it's feasible in Wisconsin. And would it be helpful either to make sure that Point Beach stays open or perhaps to develop some advanced reactor in Wisconsin eventually?
Well, I think the answer, my answer is absolutely yes, but I think that's something that you've got to deal with the Public Service Commission and the legislature to see if they're willing to do it, because this requires legislative action. The Illinois bill or passage by their legislature in New York has already gone through a number of legal checks so that they now have become a standard that others are considering. For example, Connecticut's considering a similar bill. Pennsylvania's considering a similar bill to do it for their plants because they want to keep all low carbon technologies on equal footing.
I think in order to get this passed in Wisconsin, it will need public support, which is why this program today is so important. So thanks again.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Margie. Appreciate it. Bob and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Bob.
I'm very interested in reducing overall carbon footprint and reducing the effect of energy production, but most of this discussion is theoretical because most of those decisions are made in the political and economic world. As it stands now, it seems that wind and solar are going to be a lot more economical along with natural gas, and they have startup times that are almost immediate as opposed to 100% cost overruns for nuclear and time overruns as well. In addition, our country is not fostering the research that's needed. How do you get over those political economic hurdles to get a safe nuclear source that could help reduce our climate problem?
Yeah, well, let's turn to Ray Luca.
I completely agree that we need to be able to deploy nuclear technology quickly, and I think this is part of what the government is beginning to support and what we at the university are working on in terms of advanced manufacturing and advanced reactors that can be commercialized quickly.
Yeah. If I might, the one thing that unfortunately we fell into in the United States is we lost our ability to build many things, not just nuclear power plants. If we take a look at the same technology that's being built in Georgia, which is called the AP1000 plant, it's, as the gentleman said on the phone, is a cost overrun, but the same plant just went critical and is in operation. Two plants are critical in operation in China, same technology exactly. And they were only about 6 months behind in their overall schedule. We're years behind. So I think part of it is, historically, is that we've lost our ability to build things and we lost the supply chain. So that has to be reestablished. And that's, I think, part of what Ray Luca was pointing out. With smaller reactors, advanced reactors, the hope is you can essentially reestablish the supply chain in a much more expeditious manner.
And to be a little bit more specific, one of the challenges with building a large nuclear reactor is the civil infrastructure, building the buildings, building large concrete buildings. And so we have to either relearn how to build those kinds of buildings on schedule, or we have to rethink whether we really need those enormous concrete buildings. Can't we just build nuclear technology in a factory and then ship it and plug it in and press go?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we mean when we say advanced technology and advanced manufacturing. It's rethinking what kind of construction needs to be done at the site. But probably both need to go hand in hand. We need to relearn how to build the big ones, and we need to create different types of plants that don't require that kind of complex civil structure management.
Interesting. Bob, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Joe in Eau Claire, I think it's your turn. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Say, earlier a caller talked about waste, and in your discussion, one of you mentioned the French reprocessing technique for concentrating and reusing the fuel. And with the fuel that we have now stored as spent fuel, would the French technique be useful at all in processing that?
Yeah.
The answer to your question, Joe, is yes. We've chosen not to do that primarily because of cost. It costs money to build the reprocessing plant and then to essentially recycle the fuel, as you said. And we have a very large amount of uranium both in the country and that we bring in from Canada and Australia. So from a strictly economic standpoint, it's an additional cost that current technology has chosen to not do. The electricity market in Europe is quite different and quite much more expensive, and that allows the French to have that capability or use that capability in difference to us. We have much lower electricity costs in the United States.
I would assume, though, we'd be able to, you know, we've got it all sitting there at some point in time. Would we be able to pull it out and reprocess?
If we chose to. The older spent fuel, probably not, but the newer, yes.
Yeah.
And then in terms of new reactor technologies, we can design them to facilitate that recycling of spent fuel. So, for example, molten salt reactors directly facilitate the separation of what is useful in the used fuel and what is not useful in their used fuel, and through a process that's very similar to aluminum production, which is called electroreduction. So
the new processes are going to make life a lot easier when it comes to that.
Correct, yes.
Yeah. Well, Paul in Whitewater, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I wanted just to speak in support of the safety of nuclear storage. My wife and I have a friend who currently is retired but lives in New York, in Connecticut. He worked for approximately 20 years, I believe, on the nuclear storage project in Sweden. As a matter of fact, we were just in Scandinavia and we happened to drive by as part of our tour the facility that he helped to build and establish. And basically, what I would want to say is that they have had at that particular facility absolutely no safety issues whatsoever in operating that storage facility. And his message, if you will, to me was quite simply that nuclear storage is exceedingly safe and can be so. I guess that's my point.
Yeah, Paul, thanks for calling. Ray Luca?
I think that's absolutely true. If you look at the operation of a waste repository within 10 years, 20 years, 100 years, 200 years, we have pretty high confidence that those facilities operate safely. I think the debate is really around the million-year operation. Mm-hmm. Should we be putting material underground that we have to ensure will not contaminate civilizations that we can't even imagine a million years from now? I think that's where the debate is interesting, and it goes in the realm of engineering ethics.
Well, I tell you what, this was a enlightening show for me, and I want to thank you both very much. Hopefully we can do this again down the road. I think it'd be great.
Good. Thank you.
Lots of good conversation here. Michael Corradini, former director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute and professor emeritus of nuclear engineering. He founded the Wisconsin Energy Institute in 2006. Reluca Scarlett is an assistant professor of engineering physics in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. A fascinating topic for me. I hope it was for you. And we're moving along, as we always do, and we're turning our attention to some medical issues. And next, we'll be talking about age-related macular degeneration. So I want you to stay with us for that. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.